Today's Keisho will be on Case 48 in the Mumon Kan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 48, Kenpo's One Road. A monk said to Kenpo Osho, "It is written, Bhagavats in the 10 directions, one straight road to Nirvana. I still wonder where the road can be." Kenpo lifted his staff, drew a line, and said, "Here it is." Later, the monks asked the same question of Umon, who held up his fan and said, "This fan jumps up to the 33rd heaven and hits the nose of the deity Sakra Devanam Indra. When you strike the carp of the eastern sea, the rain comes down in torrents." Mumon's comment: one, going to the bottom of the sea, lifts up clouds of dust. The other, on the top of the highest mountain, raises towering waves to wash the sky. One holding fast, the other letting go. Each stretches out his hand to support the profound teaching. They are just like two riders starting from opposite ends of the course and meeting in the middle. But none on earth can be absolutely direct. When examined with a true eye, neither of these two great masters knows the road. Mumon's verse: before a step is taken, the goal is reached. Before the tongue is moved, the speech is finished. Though each move is ahead of the next, there is still a transcendent secret. To thank everybody for coming here and to practice at our October Sesshin. And many people came in last night, and some of you have come this morning, have joined us this morning. And I'm very, very happy that everybody has been able to be here today. We've all gotten up to practice the great way, as people in the Zen tradition call Zen. And it's a pure pleasure, in my opinion. Last night we sat and went to bed, and I don't know if you noticed that it started pouring later on, and I woke up in the middle of the night, and the wind was banging around. It was really quite beautiful. And I really couldn't sleep because I was just so excited about the sesshin. I must say that I've been doing this for more than 30 years. So when I get into sesshin mode, it's quite a I don't know how to compare it. It's just like my whole being becomes like an arrow. Shot towards a bullseye, or at least towards a target, not necessarily toward the bullseye, but there's a kind of energy flow that I find myself getting into, and it's very exciting. It's really wonderful. I don't know any other way to describe it. It's like stepping into a rushing river and flowing with that river. It's just like that. So last night I woke up and the wind was really blowing, and I couldn't really sleep because I felt this tremendous energy of sesshin. I've been practicing Zen for more than 30 years, and I must say that my first sesshin was quite a challenge. So some of you are here for the weekend, and this is your first time sitting for such a long period. And it's going to be a challenge. You know, it's unlikely that you'll be able to coast through. A little later in the day, we're going to bring chairs into the room, even though it's rather crowded. Around the margins of the room, we're going to put some chairs. And if you feel that you just can't sit on that darn cushion anymore, and you're in physical discomfort, it's perfectly okay to sit in the chair. And so, you know, please have no hesitation about doing that as the day wears on. If you feel yourself unable to go forward, just get up and sit in the chair. And when you feel prepared, and you feel a little better, you can go back down to the cushion and continue to practice. This is something everybody has gone through. Everybody here sits very well. This morning people were sitting beautifully. I was so impressed because, of course, last night we sat for three periods, and then we got right up and sat for three periods again. And already, you know, that actually already begins to tire your body a little bit. But everybody just sat beautifully this morning. It was so still and quiet, and people weren't moving around like crazy. It was really great. So, you know, there's a rhythm to practice, you know. Come to Sesshin, and you might have all kinds of ideas about what's going to happen. Maybe you think you will have a Kensho experience, a great awakening experience. And indeed, you know, awakening or enlightenment is the goal of Zen practice. And so it's rational, it's logical, you know, when you come to Sesshin to think, okay, I'd like to have an enlightenment experience. But if this is your first time, or even your second time, or even your third time, or even your fourth time, it might be a physical challenge for you. And maybe by the middle of the day, or late this afternoon, you might begin to think that enlightenment is not so important. You know, maybe just surviving is enough, you know. And I actually think that's a wonderful state of mind to be in. You know, normally we're pretty finicky, you know. I don't know about you, but I have a cat whose name is Isidore. And Isidore we found on the street long ago. And he was this poor, sort of a flea-bitten, wretched cat, and we adopted him. My wife has this habit of adopting wretched stray cats, and so over our 30 years of marriage, we've had countless animals, and Isidore is our latest. So he was a cat who was living on the street, and we didn't really know he was living on the street. He looked a little uncared for. But he would come to our house in the daytime, and we'd open the door, and he'd come right in the door. And he'd sit inside. And we thought he belonged to somebody. And my wife, Barbara, would, at the end of the day, you know, when we were going to bed, she'd open the door and go, "Okay, get out." And Isidore would complain bitterly. He'd actually whine, you know. He'd meow and meow and meow. It's like, "Why are you doing this to me? Why, you know?" So after a while, we realized that he probably had nowhere to go. And so we stopped throwing him out. And so he's been in our house ever since. Maybe he just likes our house more than his old house. Anyway, when we first got Isidore, he was ravenously hungry all the time. And we could feed him anything. And he would devour it with you know, relish. So we could go to the ShopRite and get the cheap ShopRite knockoff cat food, you know. And he would eat it, he'd love it, you know. So now if you fast forward 6 years, you know, I open a can of food and he walks over and looks at it. It's like, no thanks. What else? What else have you got, you know? And my feeling is that it's annoying, but we're just like that, aren't we? You know, I went out to lunch with a good friend of mine, and we went to an Indian buffet that I like called the Soup Sagar. And it's a buffet, so you can help yourself. And he got a huge plate of food. In fact, I was watching him, and I thought, there's no way a human being could eat all that food. And indeed, he's quite a big guy, if I may say so, even he couldn't eat all that food. And so the whole, like half a plate of food went into the trash, and I thought that was a kind of a shame. But you know, he just didn't like the flavor. You know? So there's, you know, this is the way we live, right? We're like Isidore, you know? We have lots of options, and we're very picky. And you know, when you come to Sesshin, if you begin to do this for a few days, you get a lot less picky. You know, you start. You know, basically, you get up at 4:30 in the morning. By 8 o'clock, when we have breakfast, you're probably hungry. You know, and you might not really like oatmeal ordinarily, but if you haven't, if you've been up since 4:30 and you're eating at 8 o'clock, oatmeal can be like ambrosia, right? You know, and you might not like, you know, the knockoff orange juice that I bought, but you know, if you're hungry enough, it's just heavenly nectar, right? And this is going to be true for the rest of the sesshin. So, you know, eventually the moment will come where you look at some rice in a bowl, and you look at some stir-fried green beans and some broccoli, and you're as happy as if you'd won the lottery, right? That's really true. You know, but we take away a lot of things at sesshin, yeah? And you sit in a mushin, an empty mind, you watch the breath, watch the breath, watch the breath, or you call mu. And the body gets tired and the mind gets tired. And eventually it becomes possible to pare things down to the bare essentials, right? We all come thinking perhaps we'll have an enlightenment experience at a retreat of this kind, and indeed people do have such experiences. But it's more often the case that as we're sitting on the cushion hour after hour after hour, it's often the case that eventually just surviving feels like a wonderful achievement. So, you know, by the end of today or by the end of tomorrow, you know, your goal is going to be getting through 25 minutes. So you sit on the cushion and your legs are going to be sore and tired, and you start watching your breath, and maybe 15 minutes into the sit, maybe 10 minutes, maybe 5 minutes, you're going to feel a little uncomfortable. Maybe your knee has been hurting you a little bit, or maybe your back is sore. And you're left there in that situation, and all you can do is try to go deeply into samadhi. And the rules of the game are that you can't get up and run away, even though your fight or flight instinct is telling you to run. So you just keep going back to your breath, back to your breath, back to your breath, and there's a part of you that says that, you know, this is unendurable, right? But there's another part of you that says, don't worry, you can get through this, and you watch your breath, you watch your breath, you watch your breath, and somehow it's like you you sink into something. You know, maybe you've had that sensation. But when you're sitting on the cushion and you're watching your breath, you begin to feel like you're sinking down into something. I don't know how else to put it. It's as though you're suddenly stepping into a pool of warm water, and you can feel the density of the water all around you. This is how samadhi can sometimes feel. So it's like you're stepping into this deep pool of water, and basically you can feel the pressure of the water around your body, and your mind has a kind of darkness or stillness, and the pain doesn't go away, but you can sweep it away a little bit with your breath, and then you go deep into concentration. And you might do this for 25 minutes or 30 minutes. And if you're lucky, if you're really focused and things are going well, you can get from one end of the sit to the other without having to move. And when that bell rings, it's the sweetest sound in the world, isn't it? If you've been sitting for 8 hours a day for a couple of days, your legs get tired, and you want to move, but you know you shouldn't, and so you go deep into samadhi, and you get through. You start watching the breath, and then you start sinking into samadhi. But there's your discomfort, right? And so each time you face your discomfort, you focus on your exhalation, or you focus on mu sheen, calling mu as you breathe out. And it's touch and go, right? The whole time. It's sort of like it's touch and go, It might happen that midway through you just can't stand it anymore and you have to move. But, if you keep focusing on your breath, you might just be able to get from one end of the sit to the other. And it's a little bit like being on a high cliff, isn't it? It feels a little bit like being on a high cliff where you just have to go along the ledge, and it's a tricky ledge, but at the other end you'll have a big wide path again, So for the sit, you're just trying to get through. It's like one breath at a time, one breath, and that's all it takes. If you come into the zendo in the morning and you think, oh my God, we've got 8 hours of meditation ahead of us, that's going to be difficult to take. And in fact, just thinking about that scares many people off, When they think of sesshin, they think, 8 hours, I'll never be able to do that. 5 days. And it takes a while, it takes practice, really. A lot of practice to be able to do this for 8 hours. And there's a natural rhythm. We develop focus and concentration and stamina at our own pace. So if you haven't stayed for a day yet, I'm not criticizing you at all. Just keep practicing. One day you'll probably want to stay for a day, and then maybe 2 days, and then maybe 5 days. And after a couple of years, even 7 days won't seem insane, But the thing is, if you come in the morning and you think, oh my God, 8 hours, see, that does seem like climbing Mount Everest. And if you sit down on the cushion and you go, oh boy, here we go again, another hour of meditation, see. Again, that makes it seem so formidable. But if you just stay in the moment, if you just take it one breath at a time, it becomes possible to do almost anything. So you breathe out, and that's one breath. And then you breathe out again, and that's another breath. And you call mu, or you focus, you watch where the breath is going. And sometimes, not always, but sometimes, 25 minutes just goes like that. And so the point is, you only have to get through, you don't have to get through an hour. You don't even have to get through 25 minutes. You just have to get through one breath at a time. And one of the beautiful things about sesshin is that it simplifies our mind. It makes inessential things clearly inessential. And it makes just sheerly being alive, very rich and extraordinarily wonderful. So, you know, if you sit here for long enough, you're going to sit down and look at a bowl of rice and think, this is the most delicious thing I've ever eaten, and it's just brown rice. Or you're going to be so happy when you get through a sit. It's like, my God, I did it. You know, I actually did it. I got through that sit without moving. Another sit. It's like victory. You know? There's something, I think, very special about this element of Zen practice, this idea of a simplifying, stripping away non-essentials. You know, we have a ludicrous lifestyle, right? It's almost insane. We have all of these gizmos and all of these objects and all of this stuff, and we're so used to being unhappy. You know, we're so used to being discontent, and we're so used to being picky, and we lose all perspective. You know, all of us, myself included. You know, we lose all perspective. Little things seem big, big things seem little. You know, our society has all kinds of big problems. And one of the strangest things is that we don't pay any attention to the really big problems. We're really worried about small things. I myself spend too much time online, you know. And I like to read Salon.com and these sort of somewhat left-leaning online journals and blogs. And, you know, if you go out to the blogosphere, you know, something Rush Limbaugh said will be all over the blogosphere. It's like, did you hear what Rush Limbaugh said? Did you hear what? And it's just crazy, right? Who cares? You know. But it can seem very urgent because we don't know how to sort of simplify and live this beautiful life. People in old times had much less, including fewer options in life, you know. I think having options is important, but people had, I think, a kind of a richness to their lives because it was simple. My mother grew up on a farm in upstate New York, in a place called Plattsburgh, New York, which is near Lake Champlain. And she was so poor during the Depression, she said that, once a year or twice a year, her father would bring back oranges for people to eat. There'd be like a couple of oranges, right? And she said her father would go away and come back and bring her a candy bar. Not every time, you know, but once in a while. And the candy bar, you know, I mean, you know how it is now, right? You know, you see kids going into the store and they're buying like 50 candy bars. But for my mother, a candy bar was like an amazing event. I just think there are people who would say that pathetic. But I think it's wonderful, right? Because when she ate that candy bar, it was really special, really delicious. And, we just have so much, and if you're watching the television and you're online, or you're listening to the radio and you're online, maybe you're blogging, maybe you're emailing somebody and you're listening to the radio and you've got your book in front of you, you've got your schoolwork in front of you, you know. I think we all do this, but I think it's like damaging to our senses, you know. I think it's like there's a film over our senses. And it becomes hard for anything to have much impact. Maybe this is why people have become so impolite and maybe unkind sometimes. They're just sort of coarse. it's like the senses become coarse and crude, you know. And when you come to Zen, to Sesshin or to regular Zen practice, this process of simplifying, clarifying, you know, purifying body, heart, and mind on the cushion, breath by breath, is really miraculous. Because the most simple things just become wonderful. Just if you're in concentration, deep concentration, and you just hear the wind, it's so beautiful, right? Just so beautiful. You might, during one of the break periods, you might go, there's a trail behind this property, and there's actually, part of this is actually a national forest. So you can walk down that road quite a long way. In fact, I think you can walk down that road all the way to the water, if I'm not mistaken. I've never done it. You know, you might go for a little walk and see sunlight on some leaves and hear wind in the trees. And, you know, it might be like an extraordinary experience, just seeing sunlight on leaves. And if you came back from the Sesshin and somebody said, well, how did it go? And you said, oh, beautiful, sunlight on leaves, right? They think, what the heck, you know, what's that all about? How did it go? Did you have enlightenment experience? No, but I saw some sunlight on some leaves. It's great, you know. They wouldn't understand, but I think it's so important to simplify in this way, so that you know, sunlight on leaves is the most beautiful thing in the world. It's like the face of your mother, right? If you're in the right state of mind, it could bring tears to your eyes. There was a man named Soen Roshi. He was a Zen teacher. And my first teacher, Genki Roshi, studied with him. And Soen Roshi was famous for doing a lot of Zazen. And sometimes he would sit down, Nakagawa Soen was his name. He would sit down on the cushion and get up 7 hours later. You know, he was a kind of an erratic practitioner. Because some days people said he'd sit down on the cushion and his sitting was lousy, he'd move around. It was really, you know, he'd just say, I'm just not in the groove today, you know. And then sometimes he'd sit down and he would get up 7 hours later. But he was famous for the quality of his practice. You know, he could really simplify. And he was apparently Genki Roshi and other monks at Ryotakuji were having breakfast, I guess, or lunch. And Genki was seated across from Soen Roshi. And Genki was quite young at this time. And they were reciting the breakfast, you know, the sutras for the meal, for the morning meal. And Genki said he looked over and just tears were, you know, running down Soen Roshi's face, you know. And he was crying about the rice, you know. And you know, if you tell somebody about that, they just think, well, that's crazy. But, rice is, is like life itself, right? I mean, rice is Buddha. Rice is God, you know. We can't live without it. You know, if the rice crop fails, the human race will be gone, or three-quarters of the human race will be gone. It's so precious. You know, in some traditions, people recite verses that include the line, a thousand labors have brought us this food, you know. Think of all the people who have worked so hard to bring the green beans we're going to eat for lunch, you know. People might have traveled all the way from Mexico and endured great hardship to work here, to make some money to send back from their families. And they've been out in the fields picking these beans, you know. And all their kindness, all their motivation is to help others. And they're just trying to live. And they've picked these beans and now we're going to eat them. You know, and when you begin to think about things this way, I think it changes everything, right? It's just, most of us are picky. And if you do Zazen long enough, you become sort of like broken-hearted. You know, that's not something people necessarily want, right? And if you sit on the cushion for an hour, you feel a little better. And if you sit on the cushion for another hour, your mind becomes very still. But if you sit on the cushion for 8 hours, it's kind of tough. And then if you go to sleep and you get up at 4:30 and you do that again, and you do that again, after a while it's, I don't know, it's different, it's like a broken heart. If you really sit deeply long enough, you have like a broken heart. But you know, I think being broken hearted is a good thing, not a bad thing. You know, I think when we're broken hearted, we can be very kind to other people. You know, sometimes when our dreams have fallen apart and what we wanted is not going to happen, it hurts, right? Maybe you come to Sesshin and you realize you're not going to have an enlightenment experience. Maybe you're brokenhearted about that. But actually, waking up feels a bit like being brokenhearted. You know, I've talked about this before, but my brother was a pretty cynical guy. We grew up in kind of a not a very happy home, and my brother and his style was cynicism. He was incredibly funny. He had this incredible sense of humor, and it was sort of a very cynical sense of humor. But he was funny. And he was also, I would say, a little callous, you know, as he got older. I'm not trying to offend anybody, but he was a Republican, you know. And, just kidding. And he really wanted to cut funding for this and that, and he could be pretty, I thought he was, you know, I thought he was too far right for my taste, you know, and I thought he was kind of an uncaring person in a lot of ways. Not all Republicans are, of course, but some of them are. And my brother would, he used to refer to people on the street, like when he was in, we would sometimes meet in New York or D.C., and he called them sidewalk socialists. Say, the sidewalk socialists. See, that was his style, right? Sidewalk socialists. Anyway, my brother because he was such a cynical person and kind of closed up and stony-hearted sort of person a lot of the time, had predictable problems in his relationship with his wife. And indeed, she had an affair. And when my brother found out about it, it was astonishing because we weren't particularly close. But I got a call from him on the phone, and he was crying on the phone. And he told me what had happened, that his wife had cheated on him. And I was a little surprised that it bothered him so much, because he's such a tough guy, you know. And he was weeping like a baby. And the interesting thing was that it was like talking to my brother for the first time in 20 years. You know, instead of talking to that tough guy, there was some, behind that tough guy, there was this little kid I used to know who used to like to go out in the woods and bring home turtles he had turtles in the backyard and he'd feed them lettuce and raw hamburger, right? And that was a kid who used to do that, you know. And he loved animals. In fact, he had a picture over his bed of a collie protecting a little sheep in a snowstorm. You know, so very moving, right? I mean, it was a collie protecting a little lamb, in a snowstorm. You know? And so my brother had that in his heart somewhere, but it got buried in all this cynicism. And when he had his broken-hearted, heartbreaking experience, the person he used to be came out, and it was so beautiful. It was like inside that cynical person was such a beautiful heart, right? Because he had rediscovered what really mattered to him, which wasn't the Wall Street Journal. Who cares, you know? It wasn't even money. It wasn't even his BMW, really. It was the fact that the person he trusted had he'd maybe driven away the person he loved and trusted, and that she had hurt his feelings very badly. And he understood why she did it. He realized that he had not been a very good person. It was so wonderful to see that person. He called me regularly for a while he was going through this little breakdown. The other guy came back. You know, one day we picked up the phone, and I wasn't talking to my brother anymore. I was talking to the wise guy, you know, again. And it was sort of imperceptibly returned to the person, the hardened shell in which he lived his life. And that's the force of habit, right? I mean, life doesn't always give you a second chance, you know. But it gave my brother a second chance. And it wasn't true that he went totally back to his old ways. He did become a little kinder person. But I was so sorry to see that wonderful person disappear again. You know, so inside everybody is like this beautiful being. It's like, human beings are, even though it seems almost impossible to believe, human beings are all, deep down inside, are all love, you know, 100% love. I think the first thing people feel for other human beings is love, you know. But it gets lost because we waste our time in inessentials, non-essentials. You know? So when you come to Zen practice, it might seem kind of like an insane regimen. You know, sitting on the cushion hour after hour, you know, at 10 o'clock somebody will come and get you out of bed and drag you in here and make, you know, come on, sit. You know? But, you know, this is like magic. You know, this practice is like magic. You know, if you just stay here long enough, your heart will break open, and this beautiful being will come out. Yeah? And the whole way of living in Zen is based upon finding that beautiful being, and being the servant of that beautiful being. In Zen, we call that beautiful being true nature. True nature. See? Each of us has to live our own life in our own way. You know? So you might decide to be an artist, and you might decide to be a scientist, and you might decide to be something else, and something else. Your parents may tell you to do this, and your friends may tell you to do that. And you might read in the Wall Street Journal that you should think this way, and you might read in Salon.com that you should think that way. You know? And you might think you need a boat, because some magazine said cool people have boats. You know, you might think you need a new car, you know, because this isn't people who matter have new cars. You know. But we Zen people don't live that way. We Zen people serve true nature, see. It's hard to get in touch with true nature, but if you get in touch with true nature, you find the most beautiful thing in the world inside yourself. And then the Zen way of life is to serve that, that true nature, you know. And the more you encounter your true nature, the less confused you are about what you should be doing, and what you should really care about. If you live in a world of in essentials, it's like running through a foggy forest, you know. But if the more time you spend with your true nature, the more clear it is what your road in life is going to be. So here, you know, your true nature told you to come here, actually, I would say. There's a part of you that's quite beautiful, quite wonderful, and all 100% love. And it gave you this incredible instruction to come here and do this crazy thing. Yeah? But here you are. And your little mind, your picky mind, might be saying, why did I do this? What am I doing here? This stinks, you know, etc. But please don't pay too much attention to that mind. And just sit on the cushion, watch the breath, enter deep mushin, and the most beautiful thing will come out. And that's 100% guaranteed, really. We all have a different road in life, but we all have to find true nature on our own and serve it in our own way. Zen is all about serving true nature, and learning how to get in touch with that is what means to begin to walk the road of Zen. A monk said to Kenpo Osho, "It is written, Bhagavats, enlightened beings in the ten direct, they're enlightened beings in ten directions." See, north, east, south, west, and so on, there's enlightened beings. Which is the right path? So Bhagavats in the ten directions, but one straight road to nirvana. He says, where is that road? See, Kenpo lifted his staff and drew a line and said, it's right here now, if you can free yourself from inessentials. Later, the monks ask the question of another master named Umang. He doesn't draw a line. He holds up his fan and he says, this fan goes up to the highest heavens and it can go down to the depths of the ocean. So both of them have different ways of living, but they're both in touch with that beautiful, true nature. Umang's comment. One going to the top, to the bottom of the sea, lifts up clouds of dust. The other, on top of the highest mountain, raises towering waves to wash the sky. One holding fast, the other letting go, each stretches out his hand to support the profound teaching. Both are in touch with the true nature. They are just like two riders starting at opposite ends of the course and meeting in the middle. But none on earth can be absolutely direct. When examining with a true eye, neither of these two great masters knows the road. Remember that these koans are tricky. When Mumon says that, he means they both understand completely. Is one way to understand. Both understand true nature. Both understand true nature. Mumon's verse. Before a step is taken, the goal is already reached. It's already in there. That beautiful being is already in there. Before the tongue is moved, the speech is finished. Though each move is ahead of the next, there is still a transcendent secret. Oh. So everybody did a wonderful job this morning, and I'm very, very happy that all of you were able to be here and to practice, whether it's just for the morning or for 2 days or for 5 days. It's just a pure pleasure. And let's just keep walking down this beautiful road, okay?